Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Moscow to speak with the independent defense analyst Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer about the growing possibility that Putin will order his army that is massing on the border with Ukraine to invade eastern Ukraine under the guise of liberating Russian-speaking Ukrainians from a Western-backed government of Nazis and anti-Semites who are oppressing pro-Russian Ukrainians. We will look into the possibility Putin will move to annex the Russian. He will also move to annex the Russian-speaking separatist Transnistria region of Moldova, and his ominous warning to Russians opposed to him, who Putin labeled in a speech to the Russian parliament as a fifth column and a disparate bunch of national traitors. Then we will speak with Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, who shared the Nobel Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We will discuss his new article at Scientific American, Earth Will Cross the Climate Danger Threshold by 2036, and the recent Senate all-nighter on climate change, the White House's new website on climate change, and Hillary Clinton's remarks to students at Arizona State University that she hopes there will be a mass movement that demands political change to address global warming. Then finally, we will speak with a scientist who predicted the recent Big Bang breakthrough in 1983 that is now confirmed with new evidence of how the universe underwent rapid expansion a fraction of a second after the Big Bang. Andre Linde, a professor of physics at Stanford University, whose chaotic inflation theory has been verified by a team of scientists at the South Pole, joins us to discuss the significance of this discovery that has rocked the world of science, heralding in a whole new era of physics. Joining us now from Moscow is Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences from 1994 to 2005. And Felgenhauer published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. And in 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. Felgenhauer's regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local international publications. And we spoke recently, and you were suggesting that there could be a possibility of an invasion of eastern Ukraine. Now, Russian forces are, according to NATO, are in a very ready state. There's also talk of a possibility of invading a part of Moldova called Transnistria. Let's start with eastern Ukraine. Do you think that's on the table?
Well, there's a rather high possibility of Russian troops going in right now. Well, right now, meaning most likely I would bet second half of April. That would be, of course, very important to know the exact weather conditions, because Russian Air Force does not have the capability of effectively supporting ground troops in bad weather or night. So that would be also one of the essentials. Of course, also we had a very mild winter in Ukraine and Russia this year, little snow, and the spring is warm and early, so the soil is drying up, which will allow tank forces to move away from roads and kind of spread out if need be.
So,
and also, of course, as it has been said and noted by NATO commander Sakur, Russian troops are in a heightened state of readiness, which is true, but this state of readiness is going to soon evaporate, because on the 1st of April, Russia begins the so-called spring call-up of conscripts, which means that those conscripts, 130,000 of them actually, that served 1 year, and they're more or less trained and ready to, for action, and that are right now massed, in fact, on the Ukrainian borders, will have to be mustered out. Well, we can keep them for at least maybe a couple of months, but then they'll become restless and anyway have to be mustered out. And, of course, it's very essential for Russia to prevent the planned elections in Ukraine, national elections on May 25th. Which could legitimize a government that Moscow hates. So I believe, taking into account all these factors, that the time frame for a serious Russian operation in southern Ukraine especially, where the soil is good right now for action, would be most likely April, most likely second half of April, but maybe a bit earlier, and the time frame finishes maybe May 10 or something like that, May 15. In this time frame, I believe that the possibility of Russian action is about more than 80%.
And when you say the time frame would be finished, would that mean Russian tanks would be in Kyiv?
I mean, that's if we don't go, that means there is no war.
I see.
Because a comparable state of military readiness will be achieved by the Russian military only in August, September, no earlier. When new conscript, because, I mean, after the mustering out, we'll be left with conscript that served half a year or zero.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And to train up the troops, we'll need at least, well, to August, maybe September. Also, the problem is that Ukrainians are trying to put their military into some fighting shape. Of course, right now, that's being hampered by administrative mayhem. They're also trying to put into working condition their heavy weapons, their tanks, their guns, their jets. And Ukraine has enormous amounts of heavy weaponry, but most of it's in storage and is not good for use, but it can be restored since the Ukrainians have the expertise, also civilian expertise. They have a rather vast defense industry. So if they're given time to mobilize volunteers to reinforce their forces, so by August, September, they can put up a very serious fight. So right now, the Ukrainians are weak, the Russians are strong, but this will not last. This ends somewhere in May. That means it's going now or not going at all.
And what is going on with Transnistria? Is that
Transnistria is important because there's a small Russian garrison there that's cut off. It's Transnistria is a landlocked enclave sandwiched between Moldova and Ukraine. And if we have anti-Russian kind of government in Kyiv, a government not very friendly, that leaves the Russian interest and Russian small garrison in Transnistria cut flowers. I mean, they can't survive without Ukraine allowing military transport in and out. Maybe the government could allow it for some time, but if we'll continue to be on a kind of war footing with Ukraine, apparently someday they'll say that they had enough and won't allow military flights or land military connections, logistic connections to this garrison, and we lose it. So I would believe Russia would want to expand from Crimea, taking the entire south of Ukraine, border that's close to the Black Sea and Azov Sea. That means Donbas, that means Kherson, Nikolaev, Odessa, and then, of course, in the end, we reach Transnistria.
So are the Spetsnaz, the special forces, are they overstretched in Crimea? Because I understand...
Well, they've done their work already. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't have that much of them. Mm-hmm. So we'll need them, of course, other places.
I see.
And actually, in Crimea, they were mostly not Spetsnaz, but, I mean, they were in the first wave, obviously, mm-hmm. special forces. But later on came ordinary conscripts, 18-year-old kids.
So what do we make, though?
Because they are the kind of, they fill up the brigades of the Russian military, including the VDV, paratroopers, and the Marines, mostly their conscripts.
So we don't know how these conscripts are going to feel fighting Ukrainians.
Morale most likely is rather good after the successful Crimea campaign, where there was no real fighting. Mm-hmm. I believe the Russian leadership, including military leadership, would hope that there will be no fighting, that this will be just a kind of armistice excursion. That Ukrainians are waiting, Russian-speaking Ukrainians are just eager to see the Russian troops in as liberators.
Well, there are...
And, of course, and that's a fact that Ukrainian military, though they're struggling to regain some fighting capability, are still rather weak. But if we allow them to continue to muster up their forces, they can become stronger and stronger and stronger.
So what about these...
Well, we were actually, in the coming several months, will become weaker and weaker, Russians.
I see.
And this means that there's a very high temptation to go now,
so,
political and especially military speaking.
But Dr. Pavel Felkinow, already there are these so-called political tourists going in from Russia into eastern Ukraine. Are they meant to be provocateurs? Are they laying the groundwork?
Well, of course there's Russian provocateurs. In Crimea, there were the so-called self-defense forces, the Cossacks, were actually most of them were imported from Russian regions, from Kuban, from Volgograd, from other places, Stavropol, to pose as locals who want to unite with Russia. Which is, of course, normal procedure in any kind of campaign. You flood the enemy territory with different kind of provocateurs and diversionists and so on. Especially if you have they are Russian speakers and both sides are Russian speakers, you can kind of do that and it works.
But what happens when Russians start killing Ukrainians? Will that affect the patriotic fervor that's at a high pitch now in Russia?
Well, no one knows for sure before it happened. Mm-hmm. Happens, if it happens. It's not 100% probability. So I would say it's about 80% that we go in en masse soon. It depends, of course, very much on how the Ukrainians will put their act together. Will they put up a serious fight, or will they just simply disintegrate? If they disintegrate, then Russia takes on big chunks of Ukrainian territory. I think it would be seen as a great victory for Vladimir Putin. If we run into resistance and begin getting serious losses, that would be a very serious internal political problem for the regime. So it depends mostly right now. The unknown factor is how the Ukrainians will react, and are they really ready to fight or are they not? And I don't, being in Moscow, don't know that at all for sure.
Sure. Well, being in Moscow, where there was a big demonstration a week ago, I was very disturbed by some of what Vladimir Putin said in his speech to the Duma. Just quoting here, some Western politicians are already threatening us with not just sanctions, but also the prospect of increasingly serious problems on the domestic front. I would like to know what it is they have in mind exactly. Action by a fifth column, this disparate bunch of...
Well, of course, as always in a military kind of situation, warlike situation, there's going to be censorship. And there's going to be arrest of people who the authorities believe are enemy agents because maybe they're pacifists or they don't want to support Russia going into Ukraine and reuniting regions that the Kremlin believes are Russian. So, yes, of course, there's going to be suppression of any kind of anti-war expression. That's part of the deal. But that will most likely happen even if we don't go.
Right.
Yes, of course, there's very serious pressure on the Russian media, what's left of the uncensored media, because most of it is just right now very jingoistically beating the war drum.
And you're
about
with,
great Russian victories and so on. Though, of course, I mean, the official line is that there is no war, that we are just simply, this is just kind of, we are uniting with our brothers. Well, that's what people always say. I mean, authorities always say in any war.
Right, but you're with...
Especially when it begins.
Sure. But you're with the opposition newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, which is one of the last and only, I think, outlets that are not controlled by Putin. When he refers to this fifth column, this disparate bunch of national traitors, do you feel that he's referring to you?
Oh, sure.
Well, how does that make you feel?
Well, it makes me feel threatened and rather depressed in a situation when things may go really out of hand. Actually, to put it bluntly, the possibility of all-out nuclear war is not zero.
Under what scenario would that happen? Because
Escalation means escalation. If you go into military escalation, you never know where you can actually stop.
Right.
And say if Russia encounters some serious resistance, and Ukrainian military do have some rather Soviet-style but still powerful weapon systems, and, of course, they're Cold War stuff, but the Russian military is also basically equipped with Cold War stuff. And we could run into serious losses and, say, Russian, say, warship is sunk by an Ukrainian jet bomber in the Black Sea. And Russia would claim that that was actually not Ukrainian missile, but an American missile released by an American jet. And Russia, if Russia runs into serious military problems in this very adventurous possible move into deeper into Ukraine, it could claim that it's not the Ukrainians that are killing Russian child soldiers, but 18-year-old kids, but it's the Americans. There'd be talk that the Americans already secretly deployed special forces fighting Russians, American stealth jets attacking us. Any possibility is possible. I'm not saying it's a high possibility, but it's not zero. This escalating into a direct confrontation between Russia and the West, a military confrontation. It's not zero. And that could, of course, basically, in the end, possibly, again, it's not zero possibility, but small but not zero, into an all-out exchange of nuclear weapons. We're in a rather dire strait, I would say.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, given that possibility, what does NATO do? I mean, do they sit on their hands? I mean, that sounds like the smartest thing to do, but it's not the most likely thing to do. They're likely to increase more sanctions on Russia. There's more going to be more condemnation. I mean, the irony is, of course,
well, sanctions, that's not NATO's job. NATO's job is to kind of try and deploy some kind of observer force, especially in the Baltics. Again, there's a possibility to have to supply Ukrainian forces with non-lethal supplies, and they're actually mostly right now low on such supplies. I mean, they have thousands of tanks and guns, though, of course, most of them are not in full battle readiness, but they can use them, especially if they have time to work maintenance. But what they don't have is boots, socks, field fatigues, body armor, Kevlar helmets, medical kits, communication equipment, and such stuff. That's what the Ukrainian military say, that's what they don't have.
Right.
Rations.
Right.
Non-lethal stuff.
Right.
That they would very much need to put themselves into some kind of fighting position. So NATO could supply that.
Right.
NATO countries, of course, not NATO itself.
Right. Well, but just in the meantime, what we're left with is that Putin is riding high in the polls. As long as he rattles the war drums and threatens war, he's incredibly popular in Russia. He may go into eastern Ukraine in mid-April and try and get it over with earlier, but it could go through the summer. So I guess this is all about Putin. This is not necessarily about Russia, is it?
Well, it's Putin, but there's a lot of revisionists here in Russia who'd want to restore the Soviet Union. Up to now, Putin was kind of staying, at least openly, not siding with them. Now he is. Mm-hmm. And this is such revisionism is rather popular, at least in quite some circles, that Russia should regain its world standing as a superpower. So it's working okay until we run into serious trouble, until sanctions begin to bite. Ukrainian excursion, if it happens, turns out to be a bloody mess, a quagmire. And then, of course, the popularity of any government, including Putin's, will begin to tumble.
Well, I think
so. Going into Ukraine is, of course, deeper into Ukraine right now, though it's tempting. It's a high-risk strategy.
Well, it's difficult to know how much Putin, how cynical Putin is, how he's trying to distract the Russian people from his own.
Well, it's not, I think, a distraction. He's sitting in the Kremlin, okay.
Right.
There's no problem.
Right.
I mean, it's more like Saddam Hussein going into Kuwait in August 1990. I mean, if he didn't do that, he'd be still most likely ruling Iraq from one of his 200 palaces and traveling between them.
Sure, but is anybody in Russia...
Instead of being in a shallow grave.
But is that...
Sometimes dictators don't figure out what's their real good.
Well, that was my final question. Does anybody in the Kremlin inner circle, are they advising Putin? Is he getting any advice to be cautious? He doesn't listen to his generals, does he? He listens to his KGB cronies.
Well, generals can only say, well, yes, there are problems, but we're ready to go. What else a general can say?
Right.
If we're not ready to go, then he should resign.
Right.
So, and they're not ready for that.
Right. But so are you confident that Putin's getting any cautious advice or advice to be cautious?
Well, he has been always a cautious. Putin has always been a cautious politician up to now.
I see.
But maybe he being so long in power and everyone saying what a genius he is all of the time. He, as it happens again with dictators, especially those who rule for a long time, is losing contact with reality. Apparently, the German Chancellor, Merkel, just what she said.
Right. Well, he's
out. After talking to him, that he's not very fully in full contact with reality. And I would believe that's just what's happening.
Right. And, of course, his chief aide warned that these sanctions, he talked about the boss, as they call him, that this is going to, you can't back the boss into a corner. That was his warning. So it's a pretty dangerous time that we're in here, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer. And I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences. From 1994 to 2005, Felgenhauer published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. In 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. Felgenhauer's regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications, and he joined us from Moscow. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about a leading expert on climate change and his article in the Scientific American, Earth Will Cross the Climate Danger Threshold by 2036.